We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
We are navigating the joys of different internet providers and their robust systems here.
Yes.
as we record.
Yes, I warned people last night that I've been having outages, so it shouldn't come as a surprise.
Yeah, so hopefully Job will be able to be with us for the full hour.
If he drops out, though, Maria is going to throw her voice and respond as Job would.
Yes. Yeah, we've done the Vulcan mind meld, and we're all good.
Yeah.
All right, so jumping in to...
Which Maria will have PTSD from, but, you know, we make sacrifices for this show.
We do. Okay, so jumping into local.
Starting with Carmen Best and her resignation.
Yeah, I just want to kind of talk about fact versus fiction about why she resigned. Because the mainstream media and Mayor Durkan and even Best herself put out there a lot of, I think, what are fictional things about why she resigned. So I've been reading and hearing things like the city council is racist, you know, or the city council was sexist and they humiliated Chief Best by cutting her salary and slashing the police department budget, et cetera, et cetera. And I just want to get at some of these and talk about the truth behind them. So first off, the city council is not racist or sexist. And I just want to point out for folks who are not familiar with the composition of the city council that is majority female and it is majority non-white. For the first time in Seattle's history, it is not minority non-white.
And I can tell you that every department head in Seattle is going to have to take a salary cut because of the pandemic.
Yeah. And I also want to point out, too, that two of the three white male city council members voted not to cut Best's salary. So that tells you something about the motives of the city council there. And I want to also say that the salary cut was not humiliating because, just as Job said, Councilmember Sawant, not Councilmember Herbold, originally proposed to cut all executive salaries in the entire city budget that are over $150,000, including Mayor Durkan's. Now, this was voted down by the other council members, not because the other council members didn't like the idea of a pay cap. In fact, they talked about how a pay cap is a good idea, but because of legal reasons, because of bargaining agreements with city unions that would prevent that, and the possibility of employment contracts existing for upper-level executives. And also because of time, because several council members expressed because they had to pass this budget for the year end very quickly. They decided, well, let's talk about it again and revisit it for the 2021 budget. So Carmen Best is not the only one who was going to have to take a salary cut. Sawant again proposed that cut for the Seattle Police Department budget, which would have meant cutting Best's salary almost in half. So what survived was a much smaller cut of 6.5% for Chief Best and the higher cuts for the rest of her executive staff. It's not a huge cut, 6.5%, when you consider that Chief Best was set to make almost $100,000 more this year than Mayor Durkan, more than double what the City Council Budget Chair Teresa Mosqueda was set to make this year, and more than three times the median income or the median salary in the city of Seattle. So,
and also, I should point out that there's something like 300 people in the senior levels of the Seattle Police Department that make over $100,000 a year. It's a very top-heavy salary structure within the department.
Yeah, and the Seattle Police Department is notorious in the United States for having the highest-paid people in the nation in terms of people who make, some of them, more than $400,000 a year. And that's outrageous, I think, and something that needs to be revisited again by the city council next year. And so that leads me to my third point, that it was indeed about the money. And here's why this is really important for me to say that, because when I say the money, I don't mean Beth's salary or the salary of her upper executives. I mean the money spent on the Seattle Police Department as a whole, and that the salary issue is to draw the light away from that. And I want to take the whole argument back to where it originated with the calls by protesters and community members to defund the police. Now, I went back and I looked at 20 years of approved budgets for the city of Seattle. I had some time yesterday to put together a spreadsheet. And I looked at all of the available years from that are on the city's online budget archives for the last 20 years, from the year 2000 to this year's originally passed budget for 2020. And here's what I found. Over the past 20 years, the general fund budget has been cut 5 times, most often during the 3 years after the housing market collapse in 2008. But I also want to point out, too, that Mayor Durkan oversaw an overall cut to the general fund budget for 2019 just last year during what the city has been considering very prosperous times. In the past 20 years, the overall budget, so that, you know, gives you an idea of where Mayor Durkan is coming from in terms of the city's fiscal situation. She's an austerity budget person. Okay, so Shama Sawan is not being extreme when she calls these austerity budgets. That's based on fact. Okay, now in the past 20 years, the total budget, which includes the general fund budget, which the city council and the mayor can move money around in, but also the capital projects budget, which they can't because it involves loans and specific projects that the city is building for transportation, for example.
Yeah. And bond issues also.
And it includes state and federal funds that are allocated for specific projects that the funding can't be moved around. If you look at that overall budget, that's only been cut once, back in 2004, but during the housing market collapse in 2008, 2009, 2010, that caused the overall budget to grow by less than 1% per year. So that's kind of interesting to see. But in the past 20 years, the budget for the Human Services Department has been cut 5 times, most notoriously during the years that followed the housing market collapse, when a record number of people were losing their homes to mortgage and banking fraud and were in need of the services of the city in order to be able to get to stay housed, to get rehoused, to get the services that they needed to stay employed or get reemployed, the city actually cut the Human Services Department budget during those years. In the past 20 years, the budget for the Seattle Police Department has never been cut once. It has never been frozen like the overall budget was frozen for those years after the housing market collapse. In fact, it has averaged 5.5% increases per year, with the biggest increases during Mayor Durkan's first year of office in 2018 of 23.2%. And the second, you know, again, 23.2%, that's almost one quarter more. You know, there's no department in the city budget, if you look at it, that gets a 1 year increase of 23.2%, except the police department. And the second biggest increase was 9.7% in 2014. That's the year before Mayor Ed Murray declared a homelessness state of emergency in the city of Seattle. And if you look back at the numbers, there are many years where the police department gets a 7 to 9% increase per year. It is outrageous. So I want to also say that in the year of 2014, the city spent more than 4 times as much money on policing as it did on human services. In terms of the population, the city spent about $450 per capita on policing versus $104 on human services. 6 years later, in 2020, the ratios today are just slightly better. The city spends 3 times more money on policing than on human services. And that amount is $528 per capita on policing versus $164 on human services. And if we take 2014 as a starting point and then we just build in inflation increases, then the 2020 police department budget should be about $52.6 million less, or 13% lower than it currently is. So that extra $52.6 million, is something that you would expect to be able to just take out of the 2020 budget and not have a problem, right? But the city council didn't cut 13% of the Seattle Police Department budget. They didn't cut 10%. The cuts amounted to just 7%. And it's not clear that those savings can even be realized in the year 2020. Nor is the mayor or police chief, in this case, interim chief Adrian Diaz at this point, even required to make those cuts. Durkin has been defying the city council budget parameters for at least the last couple of years, not spending money that the city council has allocated for some projects and trying to move money around in the budget. And it's not clear that that's always necessarily legal.
Yeah, and her tactics, as well as the excessive funding for the police department, I keep saying they're very Trumpian, and they are, because she's emphasizing our city's equivalent of the military, our occupying force, actually, and she's cutting human services or throwing them to the police department in the case of homeless sweeps.
Yeah,
and then defying the city council.
Yeah. Now, what people often say when they talk about, well, there was a reason why the mayor, you know, why Mayor Durkin said that we had to hire all these additional police officers in 2018 is because the population has increased. But I want to point out that the population has increased by one third in the last 20 years. So it's gone from about 560,000 up to, you know, a bit over 700,000. It hasn't more than doubled. The Seattle Police Department budget has increased by 2.85 times, almost tripled. So that argument doesn't hold up. But the argument that the folks who are making to defund the police, that the police department has never taken a cut, and that it's a black box budget, we don't have a good insight into what all is in there, that's all very true. And that's something that the city council is trying to act on. Now, another point I want to make is that I don't appreciate the pity party that the Seattle Times and Mayor Durkin threw for Chief Best.
Yeah.
I have to say that. I'm talking about the Tuesday press conference and the media coverage of it, which is meant to reinforce the idea that the city council was picking on Carmen Best and hadn't consulted her during the budget process, when in fact the city council did consult members of Best's executive team at the Seattle Police Department, asking them and getting answers to the very same questions that Best later said that they didn't ask her. And the fact that Best didn't know that and still apparently doesn't know that means that she was dangerously out of the loop on what her own department and her own executive staff is doing. And I think that either
that or more likely, I think she was lying.
Yeah. And finally, here's a direct quote. What Chief Best said was the real reason for her resignation. This is a direct quote. Quote, "This is not about the money and certainly isn't about the demonstrators. Be real. I have a thicker skin than that. It really is about the overwhelming lack of respect for the officers, the men and women who work so hard day in and day out," end quote. So here she gives her reason why she's resigning. She can't do the layoffs, which every other city department is going to have to do, and they've had to do over the last 20 years and will have to do again next year. And she can't oversee structural changes within the Seattle Police Department, like moving some work to civilian staff. Instead, she's doubling down on her heavy investment in maintaining the status quo at the Seattle Police Department, in a department that has turned Capitol Hill into a war zone with every recent protest, that has a lawsuit against it about the use of crowd control weapons, a police department that shot Che Taylor in 2016, Charlena Lyles in her own home in 2017, Ryan Smith in 2019, and just recently in May of this year shot Terry Caver here in my own neighborhood on Lower Queen Anne, without good, apparently, you know, hastily and without any good reason that is in evidence from the body cam videos of his shooting. Now, that SPD continues to reject making court-mandated changes to the disciplinary process for officers accused of excessive force and has held up the city's attempts to end the police reform, to bring a good closure to the police reform process. That's the SPD, the police department that Carmen Best is saying she will defend at all costs. And so, of course, she had to leave because there has to be some changes to this, and a police chief that stands in the way of that can't continue in that position.
No, it was very clear that you know, she's not the right leader for these times and for you know, for the essentially nationwide uprising over police and law enforcement that has mm-hmm. happened. The other thing is that if she retires, as opposed to, you know, being forced out, she gets a very lucrative pension. Because it's based on her current salary, and if she had to take cuts next year, her pension yeah. would drop also. So she's eligible for retirement, and she'll have a very comfortable retirement based on her current salary and the pension that she gets from it.
So now there is one final point I want to make, too. Carmen Best did say that she took these cuts personally, and I want to point out why she took those cuts personally. Like she said, it wasn't about the pay or the salary cut. She rose through the ranks of the Seattle Police Department by doing a number of public relations jobs. The city council's budget bill that just passed, however, is going to cut most of those PR and outreach positions for sworn officers in the Seattle Police Department. Carmen Best really has been a PR figurehead for the Seattle Police Department. She actually has very little operational on the streets experience, which may be why she's taken this personally, but also why she's had trouble controlling the way the Seattle Police Department has responded to recent protests, including their abandonment of the East Precinct building in June. I think she's left operational decisions and operational oversight of the department to other members of her management team because she just doesn't have that knowledge. I want to point out, too, that Mayor Durkin is going to be replacing Carmen Best on September 2nd with Adrian Diaz, whose main experience has been community and youth outreach in the Seattle Police Department. So like Best, he has almost no operational experience. So I think, again, we can expect someone who's got a nice PR manner, who's great in front of the cameras and smooth with the media, but probably won't be able to control the department and oversee any meaningful structural changes. So that is where we stand with Carmen's resignation.
Yeah, and I want to point out also that, you know, Mayor Durkin is now tasked with finding a replacement. And that's going to be difficult in terms of attracting qualified candidates. She tends to go for nationwide searches and out of town former police chiefs in other cities. And they're not going to want to step into a situation where the city council is looking at major cuts in 2021. They're going to be very reluctant to do that. And Mayor Durkin's going to be very reluctant to look for people who want to, who are qualified to implement the kind of, structural reform, number one, that the Times call for, and number two, that that the city council is going to be wanting looking at next year for budgetary reasons, if nothing else. So I think, you know, Mayor Durkin is set up, and she's also going to be picking a new police chief in an election year for her. So I think she's primed to pick somebody who's going to come in from out of town and not be able to control the department and not going to be able – as Mayor Durkin is not willing to entertain structural reform issues.
Yeah, she said that she won't start the process of searching for a new police chief until next year because at this point she's not going to ask somebody to come in when they don't know what the police department's going to look like next year. And I think that's fair. But what I'm worried about is Mayor Durkin's propensity to have acting chiefs or acting managers fulfill long-term roles in the same way that Donald Trump likes to have acting heads of various departments of the federal government. That's something that Mayor Durkin has done with the Human Services Department and Human Services Director Jason Johnson, because the City Council wouldn't confirm him. She's just left him as acting head of that department, and that's a troubling situation and something that she may continue with the police department.
Yeah, and Jason Johnson, for people who don't remember, one of the reasons the City Council was reluctant to confirm him was that a large number of people in his own department objected to his being hired or being confirmed. So he's stuck there as a and there's been a lot of attrition in that department. So he's stuck there as acting and also enacting really kind of harsh anti-homelessness measures, which a lot of people also don't appreciate in the community.
Yeah. So we'll see how it goes with this whole with the police chief process. But I just want to say that I think the City Council did a good job, as well as they could have done, with the budget. And I can talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
On Monday, the council put the final touches and finalized the budget on Wednesday, the revised budget for 2020 that makes, like I said, potential 7% cut in the police department. That means a cut of about 100 positions out of 1,433, which is actually a little under 7% of the personnel.
One of the demands of the leadership of the Black community was making sure the cuts didn't just include, you know, moving services out of the department to other city agencies, but also cutting
Durkin's proposal.
They specified 100 sworn officers, that is officers who were on the street, and they got it. They got that exact number.
So although it's, you know, possible that those cuts won't happen this year, that they may not be put in place until early next year, depending on how long it takes for the leadership in the Seattle Police Department to actually identify the positions to cut and send out the notices for the bargaining to go, and whether or not those folks decide to challenge their layoffs. Now, funding has also been cut. This is good news for the navigation team, although I think we'll have to see if Mayor Durkin decides whether or not to find money elsewhere in the Seattle Police Department budget and the human services budget to continue to fund her pet project. Now, the council also passed a separate resolution to allow the 2021 budget to be for 1 year only instead of the usual 2 years. This actually granted a request from Mayor Durkin because of the unusual circumstances around the coronavirus pandemic, the economic recession, and the severe drop in tax revenue for 2020 and 2021 that make it really difficult to figure out what 2022 is going to look like. So that was actually a concession to Mayor Durkin.
But it's also good common sense. It really is.
Yeah, and I think it made sense to do. And then on Wednesday, the council voted 6-2 to overturn Mayor Durkin's veto of the Jumpstart spending package, which is called the COVID-19 relief bill. They're the same thing. Then they passed an amended version of that bill that cuts the funding down from their original $86 million from the city's reserve funds. And then that money would have been paid back in future years from the Jumpstart payroll tax. The new bill instead spends $57 million on COVID-19 relief, $3 million on research into community-led participatory budgeting and community-led public safety initiatives, and it moves $26 million from the reserve funds into the general fund to plug an additional gap that was identified in the city's August revenue report. The July revenue report had assumed that the Seattle economy would start reopening later this year, but the August report now assumes that the current pandemic shutdown is going to continue through the end of this year and is a more conservative estimate. It identified an additional $26 million hole in the budget. So This really made sense for the city council to say, well, okay, if we need to find $26 million, let's just take it out of the COVID-19 relief package and use that to plug the hole this year. So that was kind of a quick and easy way for them to do that. Now, the original bill would have left just $13 million in the city's rainy day fund to use next year. The new bill leaves $39 million in reserve funds for 2021 instead. That's a small concession to Mayor Durkin's demand that the city council not spend any more additional reserve funds for 2020. So,
and they'll need that money for 2021 because I'm sure the pandemic is going to go into next year.
Yeah, so the two no votes on the bill were Alex Peterson in District 4 and Andrew Lewis, who represents District 7, Deborah Juarez, who represents District 5, who would have been a no vote. She was absent this week. Andrew Lewis said that he was worried that Durkin might not spend the funds, and I have to agree with him that that's highly likely. And he wanted to try negotiating with the mayor over the next week and a half to pass a compromise bill, although I disagree with the likelihood that that would happen. Teresa Mosqueda, Lorena Gonzalez, who's the city council president, and Lisa Herbold had already spent hours on the phone with Mayor Durkin this week trying to reach a compromise, and Durkin would not budge. She demanded that the council uphold her veto and not spend any money from the city's reserve funds, any more money for COVID-19 relief. And keep in mind, again, that Durkin didn't send them a good budget for 2020 to start with. The budget that she sent to the city council for the remainder of 2020, it was difficult to comprehend. It didn't balance. It had a $23.6 million shortfall in it because the numbers just didn't tie.
And the it was shockingly sloppy.
Yeah, and the council had to spend a lot of time. The council central staff had to spend a lot of time coming up with a spreadsheet to try to reconcile the budget and identify places where they could plug that $23.6 million shortfall. And that was before they could actually look at budget amendments. So, Durkin, you know, she likes to beat her chest and say, hey, please, city council, you know, I'm asking you to do what I want you to do. But if they did what she wanted to do and passed the budget without any changes, it wouldn't balance and it would be a mess. So I think we should keep in mind here that the city council's done a pretty good job with all of this, and that even though Mayor Durkin tends to have the conservative media on her side, and that includes the Seattle Times and several of the local TV stations, she's not always right. And in this case, she's definitely not right. And that we should view the city council as having done a pretty good and pretty thorough job with the 2020 budget.
And they did it under an unusual amount of community pressure this time too.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of
and the short deadline.
Yeah, and there's a lot of community members who are really down on city council, but they've done, you know, because they didn't defund the police department by more, but they did a pretty good job with what they had.
Yeah, they identified some good, they identified cuts that if they are carried out by Mayor Durkin and the Seattle Police Department executive staff, will cut the police department budget by about 40% next year if they continue to carry them through, which means that in the 2021 budget, it'll be a little bit easier for them to find the additional 10% and to move forward on a plan to create, an agency of civilians who can respond to things like mental health, people with mental health crises, to domestic violence issues, to various nuisance calls that don't require a man with a gun to show up. You know what I'm
saying?
And
it really is an opportunity for a city council to identify ways to reimagine the police department for the 21st century, because the police department and first responders have really become first responders for all sorts of crises that, as Maria says, don't require somebody with a gun and that kind of training. They require different kinds of training that police officers usually don't have. Mm-hmm. They've become basically the social safety net in Seattle, and they really shouldn't be. That shouldn't, you know, they've got a very difficult job already without having to assess and respond to those kind of situations as well. So it's an opportunity to take that off their plate and put it, put it in the responsibility of people who have better training for that kind of situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. And when you have a mayor and a police chief who stand up and say, you know, we're defending all of the personnel in the Seattle Police Department, you can't cut any sworn officers. They're basically saying, look, you know, on the one side, they paid lip service to reimagining policing, and Mayor Durkan still uses that wording all of the time, and yet she continues to push back and say she's not willing to make any structural changes or any meaningful changes to the way the police department is structured and operates. That's a problem.
And if you look at the police department's budget, and Maria got into this a little bit last week, there's all kinds of departments in there that could easily be moved out of the police department. You know, there's all kinds of arcane departments that the city pours a lot of money into. And there's money that gets spent on things that we don't see in the budget, like the federal grants for military grade weapons. You know, why does the Seattle Police Department need the arsenal of an occupying army? They don't. That's something that the federal government's been pushing post 9/11. And at this point, the Seattle Police Department has all kinds of fancy toys that they can use for crowd control, for SWAT teams, for all kinds of situations. But we don't know what a lot of those are.
Yeah, to the point where we had journalists here, freelance journalists here in the city of Seattle who have covered foreign wars, who said that on July 25th, during the demonstrations on Capitol Hill, on Saturday, July 25th, that the Seattle Police Department turned the streets of Capitol Hill into what looked to them like a war zone. They had never seen that kind of response from a police department in the United States before. These are experienced journalists who were taking photographs and covering the demonstrations, and they said that they felt it took them right back to being in a foreign country that was undergoing a civil war, is what it looked like to them.
And Portland has looked like that at times too.
Yeah, but Portland, that was federal agents. Here, this was the Seattle Police Department, and they said, and the journalists emphasized they'd never seen a local police department treat the citizens of their own city in that way.
Yeah. Well, before the feds got to Portland, the local police there had done some of those kind of scenes too. Yeah. But it's the other piece of that is that journalists who have filed Freedom of Information Acts, and I've been one of them over the years, to try and find out what kind of weaponry the city is getting from the federal government, they can't find out. The city won't release that information. So we don't actually know what the police department has, other than it's very expensive and it's really pretty unnecessary for most situations.
Yeah. Now, the part of the budget process that the city council did included requests for reporting from the Seattle Police Department on their own budget to try to get some clarity into the black box that the police department budget has been in prior years. So to get some idea of what the different units are, what amounts are spent on things like equipment. So it'll be interesting to see what the response is from the police department in terms of what they put in those reports. And then whether the city council is satisfied with that or not. And I would encourage people to pay attention to that process. And when those documents are made available to the city council for citizens like me and other people to look at those and read through those and see if we're satisfied with the disclosures that the Seattle Police Department makes in terms of where they spend their money and what they're purchasing.
And now, I promise that we will cover that when that comes.
We will.
Out.
Yes, I will try to. I will try to cover that. Now, the city of Seattle.
Before you go on, another small item related to that. The Mayor Durkan likes to, when people ask her office for information about specific things, she likes to say, well, you can just do a public records request for that, which doesn't seem real helpful to me. No. But the irony with the current budget cuts to SPD is some of the people that are on the chopping block are the very people that carry out public records requests when citizens make those requests of SPD. So that's going to slow down getting out information that it doesn't directly get routed to city council.
Sworn officers who do that. It's not only sworn officers. There are also civilians who do that, and those civilian positions will remain. But that's also a part of the budget that the city council was looking at as potentially something that could be moved to the administrative functions of the city and taken out of the Seattle Police Department, because then it would remove the pressure maybe from sworn officers in the department not to release certain information.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good shift for the long haul, but I'm just saying in the short term, we already have local newspapers that are looking at 6 to 9 months for their public records requests, and you eliminate a few more people out of that pool that take care of those requests. And, you know, again, if you're just a regular citizen.
Well, that was also that was also in light of requiring the Seattle Police Department to do more reporting. So we'll see, too, if they have trouble with producing those reports on time.
Yeah, I think that 6 to 9 months delay doesn't have to do with the amount of time it takes them to find the information.
I don't either. I think it has to do with internal review and deciding what they should and shouldn't release.
Exactly.
Right.
Now,
right.
I want to move on and talk a little bit about the city of Seattle making concessions on the use of crowd control weapons. This week in U.S. District Court, the city of Seattle agreed with plaintiffs in a lawsuit. Protesters, the ACLU of Washington, and Black Lives Matter Seattle King County, that they would expand Judge Richard Jones's order limiting when the Seattle Police Department can use crowd control weapons. Now, the order, as amended this week, says that the Seattle Police Department can't use chemical irritants to reroute a crowd or protest as they did on July 25th. Unless it's to prevent imminent physical harm or to prevent specific acts of property damage. Okay, so there are some exceptions there, but they tried to narrow those exceptions to make them less broad.
Yeah, the July 25th demonstrations, chemical weapons were often launched with seemingly no provocation.
Yeah. Now, the Seattle Police Department also, under the order, must not deploy chemical irritants indiscriminately into a crowd, which also happened frequently on July 25th and in June. The SPD has to issue an audible warning before using crowd control weapons and allow adequate time and opportunity and space for people to disperse, which did not happen on July 25th. The SPD is prevented from targeting journalists, medics, and legal observers, and those folks should be visually identifiable, as they were on July 25th.
And they were targeted too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And most importantly, the Seattle Police Department cannot use a declaration that the crowd is a riot or an unlawful assembly as an excuse to violate the terms of this order. So that's, I think, the most important piece, because that was exactly what happened on July 25th.
Yeah, in both Portland and Seattle, the term riot has become meaningless, because the police department will just automatically issue it when they want the demonstration to be over.
Yeah, and when they want to use these crowd control weapons. And it's clear now under the new order that the Seattle Police Department cannot do that. And comply and be in compliance with the order. Now, in return, the plaintiffs dropped their request that the court find the city in contempt. Judge Jones decided then to put the case on hold until after Judge James Robart hears arguments and rules on the city council's law to ban crowd control weapons, which was passed back in June. That's expected to occur in September. So in September, again, we'll revisit this and see what James Judge James Robart has ruled on the city council's law to ban crowd control weapons.
And hats off to ACLU of Washington and BLM Seattle King County for forcing those changes, because they're important changes for protesters.
Yes, they are. And we'll see if the Seattle Police Department adheres to them.
Yep.
All right. Moving on to national. It appears...
Oh, nothing much happened.
It appears that the U.S. Postal Service is now fully under attack from the Trump administration.
Yeah, and Donald Trump actually said on Thursday in an interview with surprise, Fox News, that he was dismantling the Postal Service so as to suppress votes in the November election, which should surprise nobody. That's exactly what's happening. Louis DeJoy, the postmaster that Trump personally installed back in May, and a little bit of history on Louis DeJoy, he was one of four people who were installed by the Trump people and the Republican National Committee as heads of their finance and fundraising divisions. Interestingly enough, the other three of those have all resigned under scandal. Chris Wind, who was the chair of the RNC finance division at the time, he had to resign and pay back $20 million that he defrauded from his the company that he ran. You had Elliot Broidy, who was already both convicted of pedophilia charges and also convicted of bribery in New York State at the time the RNC brought him on. And he had to resign also under a number of other charges and ethics violations and things like that. And then you had Michael Cohen was brought on as a deputy finance chairman. We know what happened to him, and we'll talk about him again in a little bit. And then Louis DeJoy was the fourth person, you know, who was brought in. And so DeJoy is the only one who has survived and not been embroiled in scandal until now. But he has been doing Trump's bidding. Last Friday, he testified before the House, who wanted to know why he was doing what he was doing. And Trump had lied and said he never spoke with DeJoy. But DeJoy actually went to the White House and spoke with Trump immediately before the testimony. And immediately after the testimony was when he fired 23 top executives from the Postal Service, again, consolidating control under himself and helping to throw a monkey wrench into Postal Service operations. Now, he's done several things to try and do that, denying overtime to ordinary postal workers when they have backlogs in mail, and just telling them to leave the bags in the mail facilities and not deliver them, which Postal Service employees routinely do. He started removing on Thursday mailboxes from the corners in it was reported first in Portland and Eugene. In Portland, it was being done in Northeast Portland, which is a historically black neighborhood of Portland. I'm sure that was a coincidence. Yesterday, you got reports of widespread box removal in Montana, and that mobilized the entire congressional delegation of Montana to pressure DeJoy and demand why the boxes were being removed. Of course, particularly rural areas are heavily dependent on the U.S. Postal Service for all sorts of things, including delivery of medicines, delivery of bills,
Social security checks.
Social security checks are generally electronically transferred now.
Not all of them.
Not all of them, but some. Yes. Things that people are really reliant on that have nothing to do with politics, and that's why the Postal Service has until now really been not a partisan issue. The Republicans have been trying to defund the Postal Service and break the unions there for years, but the Postal Service has generally been able to resist that. It is one of the most popular federal agencies in the country, and you saw that in the response this week to the very obvious Trump efforts to game the election and use the Postal Service to do that. The good news is that the Postal Service did back down on removing the mailboxes last night, first in Montana and then nationwide after the congressional pressure from the Montana delegation. The Postal Service announced in a Friday night news dump late last night that they were going to stop removing the mailboxes. They didn't say anything about the ones that they had already removed, but they did confirm that that had been a nationwide plan, and those were just the first ones that people had noticed. The other thing that happened, and this was alerted by the head of the Iowa Postal Workers Union, who's a postal clerk in Waterloo, she was the first to reach out to media and tell them that they were removing sorting machines across the state of Iowa. And that happened across the country, more than 600. And these are the sorting machines that can process tens of thousands of pieces of mail an hour.
Flat mail, like first class letters and ballots.
Yes, exactly. And that, in doing so, they were not simply decommissioning them, they were throwing them away. They were destroying them in some cases, so that they were trying to make sure not only that they were out of commission now, but that they would be into the indefinite future. This is not a cost saving measure. That is a measure that is meant to really destroy the Postal Service.
Louis DeJoy used the excuse that, we need more space for packages because the U.S. mail now is getting more packages because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, there are other ways to provide more space than by sabotaging the delivery of flat mail, like first class letters and ballots. He didn't explore that, and he didn't seek feedback from folks with a lot of experience in the U.S. Postal Service. As Job said, he actually fired 36 or transferred 36 upper executives within the Postal Service rather than take feedback from them.
And I would point out also that DeJoy has extensive investment in other companies, and including this week he added Amazon to that portfolio, that deliver packages. So I don't think he's counting on the Postal Service to deliver more packages.
He also owns stock in competitors to the U.S. Postal Service, so that's a direct conflict of interest, and he is currently under investigation for that reason.
Yep. So we'll see where it goes. The Trump administration is still intending to try and make ballot delivery, both states mailing ballots to people and people mailing ballots back to the states, as difficult as possible as to meet deadlines.
So logistically, what is being recommended is that you have your ballot filled out and mailed in by at least a week before the election day. And in some states, that's going to be very, very difficult to do. Some 40 states received letters from the legal department of the U.S. Postal Service this week saying that that the U.S. Postal Service cannot guarantee that it will be able to deliver ballots timely to voters and deliver those filled out and completed ballots timely back to the election departments in 40 states.
It's 46 states.
Well, partial warnings for six of them, but for 40 states, it was a full warning that 160 million voters in those states could risk being disenfranchised if they don't return their ballots to the election departments on time. And that's unacceptable. And I think some states are trying to remedy that. A couple of states have gone to court to try to delay their ability to count to receive and count ballots at least through the Friday after the election day, if not a full week after the election day. Other states are scrambling to try to provide more ballot boxes for people to drop off their ballots rather than mail them back. And there are other things states are trying to do. But
In Washington State, Bob Ferguson is considering a lawsuit as well.
Yeah, and Washington State was one of the ones that received a partial warning saying that people should mail their ballots in by up to a week before the election. So for those of us here locally who are listening to the program, mark your calendars, mail your ballot back.
And, And I would also encourage people to pressure the King County Council to provide King County Elections with funding for more drop boxes.
For more drop boxes, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Woohoo.
Well, it's looking like it's going to be a pretty interesting fall.
Yeah, indeed.
The nice thing about here in Washington State, in particular here in King County, I don't know about the other counties, but you get a little receipt with your ballot, a little piece that you tear off that has a number on it, and you can go to the election site and type in that number and track your ballot and see when it's received and when it's counted. And I would encourage people to do that. Just track your ballot this time around and make sure it gets counted. And if it doesn't, then raise ruckus.
Yep.
All right. Moving on. Jav, you mentioned Michael Cohen.
Yeah. He's got a new book coming out that the Trump administration was trying very hard to prevent the publication of. And he released the foreword to it on Thursday, and it was quite explosive. It contained hints that he had included in the book descriptions of a number of times that he had broken the law on the behalf of Donald Trump, which is no surprise, honestly, but it's going to have an impact when it comes out. The review copies of that will actually start going out next week, so we're going to start hearing about them from media figures pretty soon. One of the things that he specifically mentioned in there was that, aside from the fact that he helped pay off porn stars, was that he had helped Donald Trump cheat on taxes. And he said specifically, and this really should have been the headline, although it wasn't, because he made mention that there was a golden shower scene with Donald Trump in Vegas one year, which is the salacious part of it. But really the important part of it was his emphasis that Donald Trump will do anything, absolutely anything, to stay in power, is Cohen's assessment of his personality and his history. That come November, he is not going to cede power. He is not going to, under any circumstance, unless he cheats his way to some kind of electoral college victory, he will not allow Joe Biden to come in the White House. He will not consider it a legitimate election, and he will try and stay in power. And, you know, we've seen with the evolution of other dictatorships around the world that Trump is very closely following their playbook. There's not a lot of different things that they can do. But he has defied court decisions in the case of Congress and the subpoenas and some of those things. He has labeled media the enemy of the people, which is a setup for trying to shut down various types of media. He has also threatened social media with government regulation. He has, he's doing a lot of things with the election, not just the Postal Service, but voter suppression and any number of different Republican tricks that they've done over the years to try and disenfranchise Democratic leading areas of the country. These are things that Donald Trump is employing. We know of at least three countries now that he has asked for assistance in the election. Russia is actively interfering, according to the assessment of intelligence agencies already. And then there's China and Brazil also that he has asked that don't appear to be actively influencing the election. But, you know, who knows? And who knows who else he's asked? He could have asked North Korea for all we know. These are the tricks of a dictator. And we've seen this over and over with people like Erdogan in Turkey, who Trump admires, Putin in Russia, who Trump admires, and some of the other, Duterte in the Philippines, some of the other dictators that he is openly admired, have been using these, techniques as a way to pave the way for indefinite rule. And I think people need to be thinking about how the Democrats should respond and how we should respond in the streets if that comes to pass. Hopefully it won't. But, I think any kind of objective assessment of Donald Trump and what he's been doing and what he's been saying, you know, one of the, one of the sort of bedrock rules of, you know, narcissist would-be dictators is, and we saw this with Adolf Hitler when he wrote Mein Kampf, and then he went and did exactly what he wrote in that book, you know, in the coming years in Germany. You know, when Donald Trump says he wants to do something, believe him. You know, he's telling the truth in that case. So, in almost no other cases, but in that case. So, you know, I think we need to be prepared for this fall to be, as Mike just said, very interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, every time I go out because of the pandemic, I make a risk assessment. And I think this is one of those times where the risk assessment would, make me lean very heavily in favor of putting on a mask and getting out in the street. And
yep.
I would hope other people would do the same.
I would hope it happened in every city and town in the country. It really is American democracy, flawed as it is, at stake. You know, we've got a lot we can still lose.
Yeah.
All right. Just a few minutes left. Jav, can you give us an update on where we are with the pandemic?
It doesn't look good at all. You know, some states are plateauing out that have been problematic, like Arizona, but a number of other states are still setting records for deaths, Florida and Georgia in particular. And the Southeast is really in trouble, and they're in trouble because of schools reopening. We saw, you know, Donald Trump trotted out at his alleged daily briefings a new doctor that he found from the Hoover Institute in Stanford, who was not an infectious disease expert, but is willing to parrot a lot of things Trump has been saying, including that schools should reopen and that kids aren't much at risk. Well, kids aren't much at risk, but there was a new study that came out last week that showed that kids had 100 times the viral load in their respiratory tracts when they get COVID-19 that adults do. That means they're much more likely to spread it to classmates, to teachers and school staff, and to parents and family and their friends. It really exacerbates community spread. And we're seeing that in states in the Southeast that opened schools a couple weeks ago. We're already seeing major clusters of COVID-19 break out in Tennessee, in Georgia, and Mississippi among people associated with specific schools, where entire school districts are having to shut down because of COVID-19. And this is going to get worse as schools reopen across the country. And this is explicitly the fault of the Trump administration and people who respect the Trump administration and follow their guidelines, governors and school district managers, who believe the crap coming out of the White House. And it really is dangerous, and it's going to cost a lot of lives. It's a perilous time. It's not a time to relax in terms of mask wearing, social distancing, all of that.
All right. Events.
Well, we still have the morning and evening marches going for BLM and racial justice. You can find out specific places that people are convening. The Morning March Seattle is a Facebook page that will tell you where to go in the morning. They meet at 8 a.m. each day. And then in the evening at 7:30, all one word, Seattle Evening March. That's the Instagram account page there, and you can find out the details on where the evening march is meeting. They've been going to houses of elected officials and Dow Constantine and other elected officials to pressure them to defund police and make other racial justice investments. So you can participate in those whenever you have a chance, and they're still going. So go check it out.
Well, we will look forward to hopefully talking with you both this same time next week.
Sounds like a plan.